In every profession, in every organization, there is a need for uncommon leadership, a need for leaders who can consistently produce successful results.
One of the things that we know with certainty is that where there is a commitment, where there is a willingness to do the work, there is a possibility to turn around otherwise impossibly negative situations. There was nothing wrong with the Chrysler Corporation that a little leadership couldn't cure. And there's nothing wrong with any organization in America that could not be cured with leadership.
As we approach the new century, executives are constantly updating management thinking, discarding old outmoded techniques in favor of powerful new approaches that are far more productive. With insight and precision, renowned management expert Clay Sherman specifically outlines what these new methods are and how you can use them to become a winning leader. He explains how to stay focused on key result areas, how to delegate effectively and develop employee potential. You'll discover how to build and use power in positive, constructive ways, how to gain support within your organization and sell yourself and your ideas. Clay Sherman is a prolific author, seminar leader, and management counselor. He's president of his own consulting firm and is a respected educator and advisor to executives of major corporations. Before becoming a consultant, he served as management development specialist for the Upjohn Company and as personnel director for over 70,000 employees for Upjohn Healthcare Services. Clay Sherman knows what it takes to be an uncommon leader. He has a unique ability to see past the standard attitudes and practices to the trend-setting methods employed by today's top achievers.
These are not different people. They're people who have decided to make a difference, regardless of their circumstances. These are people who have dared to be great. In like fashion, I dare you to do the same.
And now, Nightingale Conant Corporation is pleased to bring you The Uncommon Leader.
Hello, I'm Clay Sherman. In a recent editorial entitled, Where Management Fails, Lester Thoreau, dean of the business school at MIT, wrote, "When American industries first started to fall behind their foreign competitors, the phenomenon was dismissed as isolated cases of bad luck. The American steel industry just happened to be slow in shifting to oxygen furnaces and continuous casting. Consumer electronics just happened to miss the significance of the transistor. But as the list of industries that have been conquered or need government protection to survive has grown, it's become increasingly obvious that something is systematically wrong with American management." Thoreau goes on to say that where there have been productivity failures in key industries in the United States, at heart that is a management failure. That where there's been a decline in quality and an increase in mediocrity, that too is at heart a management failure. And Thoreau holds that when employees no longer show the willingness to work or the kind of morale necessary for excellence, that too is a management failure. It reminds me of the story of the cowboy who was riding over the hills of northern Colorado. He chanced upon a trail, decided to follow it for a while, and there, right in the middle of the road, he came across an Indian lying on the ground with his ear held closely to the earth. The cowboy reined in his horse. The Indian began speaking. The Indian said, "Wagon. Wagon drawn by horses. Two horses. One dapple gray, one palomino. Passengers in wagon, two passengers, one man, one woman. Woman wearing blue calico gown, man driving." And the cowboy said, "That's astonishing. You mean you can tell all of that just by listening with your ear to the ground?" The Indian said, "No, they run over me half hour ago." The recent history of many organizations and industries in America might well be entitled, How Management Got Run Over. As many organizations were found unable to compete, as foreign competitors showed that they were more aggressive, more quick to respond, more willing to innovate and outmaneuver, it became a humbling time in America. Global developments hurt the national economy and taught us some very humbling lessons. In the closing years of the 20th century, it's become painfully clear that there's a need for uncommon leaders, men and women who will address the problems of the day. The need for uncommon leadership was further underscored by Bob Hayes in his now classic 1980 article entitled Managing Our Way to Decline. This convincingly demonstrated how the all-too-common brand of American management had, in shameful fashion, given away the store. In every industry and throughout this country, there is a need once again for those who will step up and do what needs to be done. Playing it safe has been playing to lose. One of the greatest problems in this country is that we have too many members of the managerial elite who in their preparation never read the first book I read in management. My mother gave it to me when I was 7. It was entitled The Little Engine That Could. Henry Ford said it this way: think you can, think you can't, you're right either way. If managers believe their problems are overwhelming, they will be. If managers believe investment in the business doesn't pay off, it won't. If managers believe workers don't want to work hard, they'll have lax workers. And if they believe that problems can't be solved, why then, of course, they won't be solved. Management has foreclosed its mind, its rejected ideas, without hearing the possibilities. On the other hand, where managers believe in themselves more than they believe in their problems, where they believe that they can make a difference regardless of those problems, then chances are they will be able to make the difference. The ability to make a difference has become such an important theme in the leadership studies that there's now a profile of the uncommon leader. What is it that distinguishes these men and women? First, they're no different from the rest of us. They don't have superior genetics. They're not made out of different protoplasm. They don't necessarily have better educations or nicer personalities. Uncommon leaders, in fact, are common men and women who reach beyond their present problems. If this were a sports analogy, we would say that these are players who play over their heads. In 1941 at Pearl Harbor, most of the Pacific Fleet was destroyed in a surprise attack by the Japanese. It was a disaster that started a dark era, an era offering a foreboding future. But in 1942, the U.S. hit back with a surprise of its own at the Battle of Midway. In heavy, overcast fog, Admiral Bull Halsey and his forces, outnumbered 5-1, surprised the Japanese Navy. And even though outnumbered, Halsey's ships destroyed much of the Japanese fleet, thus neutralizing the advantage the Japanese had held since Pearl Harbor. He came back to America a great national hero. He was given ticker tape parades down New York avenues. People made much of him, so his comment on the event is all the more telling. Wrote Admiral Halsey, "There are no great men. There are only common men, forced by circumstances to greatness." That, too, is a characteristic shown in studies of uncommon leaders. Recently, I was in St. Petersburg, which I suppose is the geriatric center of the universe. There I heard the story of the 3 golfing buddies, each in their 80s. They wanted to play a round of golf at the local course, but wanted a fourth and asked the golf pro if he could team them up with someone. Only they said he's got to have good eyesight, because while we can still hit the ball pretty good, we can't see where the darn thing goes. "Got just the guy," said the golf pro. "He's 95 years of age, but he's got the eyes of an eagle." "Great," they say, "team us up." First tee, first 80-year-old hits the ball, sails off pretty good. He turns to the 95-year-old and says, "Did you see where it went?" The 95-year-old replied, "Yep." "Yeah." "Well, where'd it go?" said the 80-year-old. "I forgot," replied the 95-year-old. Many organizations and perhaps their leaders have forgotten some of the fundamentals. A study of uncommon leaders shows they practice certain fundamentals and believe certain things, some of which were created by leaders in our own history. And perhaps it isn't forgetting, but remembering that we need to do at this time in our own managerial careers and organizational histories. What I'd like to do now is present the five major characteristics common to these uncommon leaders. This framework will be useful in setting a foundation for the rest of what we're going to be talking about in this album. As we go through these, you might ask yourself how well you measure up on each of these five elements. The first major headline is that uncommon leaders recognize who they are and what they're worth. One of the things we know is that if you're a man or woman in management, you represent one of 7% of the workforce entrusted with supervisory management or executive responsibility. One writer has called you the leadership elite. Another has described men and women in management as the command generation. And for each person in management, there are 13 others who don't have such responsibilities. Do you recognize who you are? Do you understand what you're worth? I'm not suggesting that uncommon leaders get up in the morning, look at themselves in the mirror with admiration, or necessarily think of themselves as God's gift to their industry. But they have an awareness that if it is to be, it's up to me. An awareness that while the day is full of problems, it is also full of opportunities. Uncommon leaders realize that the clock of life is running and that they must do something now. Lyndon Johnson wrote that when he was age 21, he sat in a one-room schoolhouse in Texas. It was a day in May, as he recalled, and looking out the window across a hazy meadow, he had the vague feeling that he was supposed to be someplace else, doing something else. Sometimes it comes to uncommon leaders in a gradual way, that they have potential and that they should use it. In fact, every member of management is a steward, a holder of a public trust. It is not their job. It's a job they do on behalf of others, for the customers they serve, the assets with which they've been entrusted. They view it not just as a 9-to-5 occupation, but as something infinitely more meaningful. They see the importance in what others see only as the mundane. Bob Dylan wrote in a song, "You've got to serve somebody." Eventually, it all gets down to that. And uncommon leaders have this concept about their job, that they're there to serve. They recognize who they are. They are servants, and they recognize what that is worth. Alfred North Whitehead, perhaps the greatest educational philosopher this country ever produced, wrote, "A great society is a society in which men and women of business think greatly of their function." Do you think greatly of your function? Do you see the greatness in the tasks at hand? Do you sense that they could be the source of your own personal greatness in this life? If you do, then you may be an uncommon leader. The second major characteristic shared by men and women who are uncommon in their leadership is that they serve the customer. Marshall Field wrote that the customer is king. That is perhaps the strongest statement ever uttered by a giant of American retailing. If this were a medieval society and the king summoned us to the throne room and said, "Jump," what would be our response? John Wanamaker, who started the first department store in the history of the world, older than the American Revolution and still going strong, wrote something about the customer that every man, woman, and child in this society knows. Linguists tell us that if you look at the phrases and slogans that a culture memorizes, they will reveal the core values of that culture. The customer, wrote Wanamaker, is always right. Think about what these giants of retailing said. The customer is king. The customer is always right. And think then of the last time you drove across town, taking your time, spending your gas, carrying your credit cards, to go to a retail establishment to give them money, and what was it that greeted you behind that counter? Was it the spirit of John Wanamaker? Was it the persona of Marshall Field? Or did you encounter a clerk jerk? The sad reality is that in much of American industry, we find organizations far more interested in having customer conformance than in providing organization performance. That is, they want you, as the customer, to conform to their policies and often ridiculous ways of doing things more than they are interested in performing to meet your needs. I had one of these experiences recently when my wife took me on the annual shopping expedition. I hate to go shopping. I've encountered so much in the way of terrible management in these organizations that I don't even want to go anymore. Unfortunately, I'm married to a professional shopper. She has a black belt in shopping. At any rate, we had gone to pick out a new suit, and once that was accomplished, she said, "Honey, I think it'd be nice if you accessorized." I said, "Well, what did you have in mind? High heels and a bag?" She said, "No, but I thought it'd be nice if you had a nice new tie to go with your new suit." So as one does on these occasions, I said, "Garcon, bring me a cravat." The fellow brings me an Italian handmade silk job for $85. Being the tight Midwesterner that I am, I struggled to maintain my composure and tried the second time to communicate. "Actually, I'd like to see something slightly less expensive in a tie." The guy brings me a tie, and we're now down to $62.50. Seeing that I was still failing to communicate, I said, "Actually, I'd like to see something cheaper in a tie." And so he brings me a tie that is $47 this week only on sale. And finally, losing all pretense of being cool or in control, I said, "I want to see something really cheap." And the guy hands me a mirror. We all can tell stories of customer abuse, and we like to regale our friends and to damage these organizations every chance we get. You'd think they'd learn the basic message that uncommon leaders already understand, that their role is to be of service to the customer. As we honor that customer, as we meet their needs, as we go out of our way to make sure that they don't encounter barriers or grief, they reward us and make our job secure. They give us greater market share. They increase our profitability. In one study done by the Harvard Business School, corporate chieftains of Fortune 500 companies were asked what they thought about Wanamaker's statement that the customer is always right. A majority of the executives said that, yes, it's a nice piece of philosophy, but that the literal truth was that the customer was not always right. They equivocated, backed off, found reasons to go around Wanamaker's central truth. There was a minority, however, of leaders who said, "Yep, that's the way it is. No ifs, no ands, no buts." And among that minority, the Harvard researchers found higher sales, higher profitability, and greater market share. You see, that's how the market rewards such simple understanding. Perhaps every customer isn't right. Perhaps there are tough customers no one could please. Perhaps there are customers who make unreasonable demands. But if we run our businesses with that kind of defensive mindset, we're going to run straight into the brick wall of turning people off, people who are sick and tired of being treated like they're wrong. One of the key statistics in retailing is sales per square foot. And the retail store in America with the highest sales per square foot is Stu Leonard's Dairy and Grocery in Connecticut. It's been termed the best managed business in America by Tom Peters. Stu's volume has grown so rapidly, he's had to put on 25 additions to the original building in the last 15 years. People come on tour buses from hundreds of miles away to see his operation. It's an absolute phenomenon. At the entrance to the store is an 8-foot by 8-foot sign greeting all customers. The sign details Stu Leonard's two rules for doing business. Rule one, the customer is always right. Rule two, when the customer is wrong, reread rule one. Now you tell me, if you were a customer walking into Stu Leonard's door and had that 8-foot by 8-foot sign greeting you, what would be your initial feeling about Stu's business? The customer is king, and the uncommon leader knows that his job is to serve the king, not to control the king or refuse to do his bidding. Edward R. Telling, the recently retired chairman of Sears Roebuck — they must know something about serving customers, they've got the biggest building on the planet — in a recent address to shareholders said, "Institutions that can no longer provide their customers with a product they want to buy at a price they want to pay for it have lost the right to survive." This is a harsh judgment, but it is the judgment of the marketplace and of the customers for whom we all compete. If you believe that serving the customer is at the core of your job, and you pursue that goal with passion, you may be an uncommon leader. The third characteristic of uncommon leadership is that these men and women know how to release the power in people. To be a leader implies that others are following you. Managers who fail to develop willing and devoted followers aren't leaders, they're just holding titles on the organizational chart. It's my observation that most people working in most organizations in America are not being led, they're being administered. They're treated as personnel, not as people. Even the language indicates how managers have divorced themselves from those they lead. People are classified with such distinctive labels as superior and subordinate. And yet J.C. Penney, who called his stores the Golden Rule stores because that's the way the customer and the people who worked within them should be treated, said, "You will never call them your subordinates. You will never refer to them as your people. They are your associates." One of the things that J.C. Penney understood was that he couldn't do the job all by himself. He had to extend his vision and his capability and his direction through the hands and minds and hearts of thousands of others. He had to multiply his abilities through his associates. And if we're going to release the power in people, then we must give them the opportunity to achieve something significant. To achieve something significant implies the managers must first delegate with a vengeance. They must give people not only real responsibility, but real freedom and authority to take action. And when people achieve, when they get the job done, managers must shower them with the three R's of management. And the three R's are recognition, reward, and reinforcement. The central reality of every business enterprise is that all its assets are depreciating in value through time. The technology, the knowledge base, the time, the capital equipment are all depreciating. And it's possible even that the human assets of the business are worth less this year than they were a year ago. But uncommon leaders create a situation in which the human resources of the organization appreciate in value. People under their leadership become worth more. They become more knowledgeable, more willing to take risks, have higher morale, and have a sense of being a member of a team. These people become something to be reckoned with in the marketplace. On the occasion of Thomas Alva Edison's 80th birthday, he was honored all across America. No other scientist has ever had as great an impact on society as did Thomas Edison. His inventions so transformed our society and the common life that men and women referred to him as the Wizard of Menlo Park. He was greatly admired, greatly respected, greatly appreciated for the major contributions he had achieved in raising the standard of living for an entire nation. One reporter asked him which of the many thousands of inventions he considered to be his greatest. He might have answered the light bulb or electrical transmission or the phonograph, but his instant reply was the research laboratory. What many people don't know about Thomas Edison is that he invented the research lab. He gathered around him approximately 300 engineers, tinkerers, inventors, craftspeople, and to each in turn he would give sketches, drawings, and suggestions about how to pursue one project or another. He multiplied his genius through the minds of 300 others, and thus achieved more U.S. patents issued to a single individual than any other American before or since. By releasing the power in others, he became an uncommon leader. How does one lead people? The astronauts tell us that from the distance of outer space, only one man-made object can be seen. The cities aren't visible, our buildings, our bridges are not visible. Only one man-made object can be seen, and that's the Great Wall of China. It's 125 feet tall, 70 feet wide, and 500 miles long. All of it built by hand thousands of years ago. One of the writers of that time, the great philosopher Lao Tzu, noted that some sections of the wall, under the direction of some leaders, seemed to be going up a lot faster than other sections. He observed that some work supervisors seemed to get a lot more done with the people than others did. And Lao Tzu wrote, "To lead the people, walk behind them." There are far too many men and women in management overly concerned with their status and in wanting to be out front and above the others. And then there are some whose common sense and humanity puts them on the same level as their people. This style can release far more people power than those whose insecurity and lordliness distances them and turns off the proud men and women who work for them. If you believe that the most important project and priority you have today lies in building and strengthening the people who work around you, you may be an uncommon leader. The fourth trait that uncommon men and women share is that they act like they own the place. Nearly all American organizations are less than 100 years old. The corporation as an organizational entity is a relatively new phenomenon in world history. Entrepreneurs started most of these organizations. They were individual owners who risked everything they had to buy their own jobs. As the organization continued down a timeline, these original entrepreneurs, risk takers, men and women of vision, were replaced by professional managers, people who were employees of the organization. In the 1950s, a whole series of writers began to open up and attack this group. A book called The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit described people who obtained a whole long list of privileges while blending in with the organization. They failed to lead and advance. They lacked the vision and ability to take risks shared by the company's founders. The men and women of the gray flannel suit were all too often found to have gray flannel minds. One of the hottest topics today is how to return entrepreneurial thinking and risk-taking behavior to our organizations. Studies have shown, for example, that professional managers don't spend money as carefully as the original founders would. The original founders spent money in a tight-fisted way, as though it was coming out of their own pocket, because it was coming out of their own pocket. Today we see professional managers who have art collections, compete for architectural and landscaping awards, and a fleet of corporation aircraft. Another study found that professional managers don't take big enough risks. They make nickel and dime bets and get nickel and dime results, whereas the founders were often more willing to bet the entire business on a new venture. And when they won big. If you're going to act like you own the place, you're going to act like the great men and women of vision who started your organization. One of the first things you're going to have to do is tear up your job description. Forget what it says you can or can't do, and instead look around the field of battle and ask yourself, what needs to be done? John Fulton was one of the great pioneers and developers of the state of Arizona. He became the most wealthy man in the state, the largest landowner, a big industrialist. He spurred the economic development within the Great Southwest and particularly the state of Arizona. On the occasion of his 80th birthday, a number of the notable and quotable had gathered to pay him their respects, and there were many anecdotes told that night of Fulton's early life. One of these stories concerned itself with how John Fulton, at age 21, had first entered Phoenix with no possessions, no shoes on his feet, nothing except a small hobo's pack on his back. And from that humble beginning had come the great enterprises and the great wealth. One of those in attendance, Senator Abraham Ribicoff from Connecticut, came up to Mr. Fulton after the program was over that night and said, "Mr. Fulton, I just can't get that picture out of my mind of how you arrived in Phoenix so many years ago, no shoes on your feet and no belongings except the pack on your back. Tell me, what was in that pack?" And John Fulton, with a big Havana cigar, took a puff and blew it into the air, looked at Senator Ribicoff and said, $2 million. It helps, I guess, to have a little starter." Uncommon men and women in leadership know that in their corporate responsibilities, they've been given a lot of starters. They've been given an organization that's up and running. They've been given the resources of that organization, its existing patents, its technology, and staff people. And they know that it's their job to do something with it. They know what it means to spend the money tightly on the one hand and gamble it all on the other. to be people of vision, to run the place as though it were their own, to take that kind of responsibility. As one corporation president confided to me recently, there are secretaries in this organization that act like they're the president to a far greater degree than many members of the management team. I suggested to him that perhaps he ought to start considering them for promotion. He thought about that for a split second and then hit the desk with his fist and said, "You're right." Not only will your career prospects brighten with this attitude, that this is your place to run, but you'll have a lot more fun doing it. Daniel Hudson Burnham was one of the great architects of Chicago. He was one of Frank Lloyd Wright's teachers, and many of the great buildings in Chicago are monuments to Burnham's genius. In a graduation speech to a number of his students, he said, "Make no small plans. Dream no small dreams." There just isn't time, you see, for anything less. If you have reached that point in your career where you're taking personal responsibility, if you're acting as though the success of the entire enterprise depends on how well you perform your task, then you may be an uncommon leader. A fifth and final characteristic of uncommon leaders is that these men and women do what they do with excellence. That is the standard. That is the only standard. There's no other standard. They absolutely refuse to accept anything less. They absolutely refuse to manage mediocrity. There is no joy in mediocrity. There's only joy in excellence and the winning of significant goals. A few years ago, the best-selling book in Japan was entitled The Great American Disease. In it, the authors told of how great American corporations, which had been examples to the Japanese in the post-World War II environment, had compromised product quality. The book detailed how the firms failed to honor the customer. They deliberately cheapened goods and misled the market. And other organizations failed to stand by their people in tough economic times and instead sacrificed their jobs to unemployment. The book set off a marked controversy in Japan. The Japanese couldn't believe the organizations that had been the great leaders of their respective industries could have ever fallen to a state of such ignorance. It reminds me of the saying on an English tombstone in Highgate Cemetery outside of London, on which the dear departed had left these words, "I told you I was sick." Well, America's been sick. It tried to spare effort, and it met disaster. How in the world could managements have ever thought that the market wanted junk? How in the world could any manager ever believe that management, which is a game of winning, could be played as though winning didn't matter? In his classic book, Up the Organization, Robert Townsend wrote, "If you don't do it excellently, don't do it at all. Because if it's not excellent, it won't be profitable. If it's not excellent, it won't be fun. And if you're not in business for fun or profit, what are you doing here?" If you work at the excellence game as though it were deadly serious, then you too may be an uncommon leader. Some time ago, on a flight from New York to Los Angeles, I had the opportunity of sitting next to a man who was 96 years old. He'd literally spent his childhood in another century, and it was good for me to just listen to him. As we talked about various issues of the day, I noticed that he had an almost completely contrary point of view from that served up in the evening news. He was truly an independent thinker who challenged the conventional viewpoints served up in the newspapers. It was instructive and challenging to converse with him, and as we took leave one from another at L.A., he turned to me and said, "Clay, make it a good day." I turned back to him and said, "What did you say?" He said, "Make it a good day." That simple fragment of conversation has haunted me ever since. And so today I ask that you not have a good day, but that you make it a good day. Make it a good career. Make it a good company. Make it a good society. Make it a good neighborhood, a good family. And to do these things, you must become an uncommon leader. How can you make it a good day, no matter where you are? I'd like to talk to you about leadership strategies as they are practiced on three very different levels. The first level I would label the superficial and the erroneous. There are a lot of prescriptions for instant success and leadership made available by the popular press. A second level represents a more solid base of true power and success in leadership. And third is what I call the level of uncommon leadership performance. Let's examine each of these in depth. The first level is the superficial and erroneous. Are these the kind of terms with which you'd like to be described? Can you make it simply by appearing to be in control? There are those who say that the name of the game is to shove others aside. There are those who say you can win only through intimidation. Have you noticed, for example, the increased aggressive driving on the highways? Have you noticed the increased homicide rate in society as a whole? Have you noticed an increasing use of intimidation and power in the negative sense in your own organization? Indeed, there is a whole generation of false leadership that has turned the word boss into a four-letter word. And that word has become the actions of their lives, double S-O-B spelled backwards. Others would tell you that the true use of leadership is to demonstrate an overriding authority and power over others, and that your location in the hierarchy, your specific title, the size of your office, are the true indicators of power. And while I don't deny that these may represent outward signs of power, I'm wondering if that really is where we ought to be focusing our attention as we think about where our careers are going and what we want to be known for in the organization. Some managers who think they're in the horse race with you may be jockeying for office position and title, and you instead may be thinking, how can I provide an additional economic advantage that will benefit my organization? There's a big difference in that kind of thinking. Another example of this management superficiality is that these people think that negotiation is the name of the game and that you can always bargain your way to success. I would ask the person that thinks that nothing is impossible to dribble a football. The fact is that sometimes in leadership you can negotiate, and I'm certainly in favor of persuasion and negotiation as a power strategy. But at the same time, you have to recognize that sometimes in leadership things are non-negotiable. There are times in which you have to take a position, and you're not going to be liked for it. But at that moment in which you make that decision and stick with it, in the loneliness of your command, you have in fact exercised uncommon leadership. One last illustration of this superficial nonsense that is being served up at the bookstores is the concept that somehow if you would wear the right attire, all will be yours. If you buy your suit at the right place, have your monogram positioned accordingly, never wear a paisley tie when a striped tie will do, that somehow success will be yours. I would simply suggest that in your organization, you better have more than your suit going for you. And so beware this superficial, phony, snake oil level of management understanding. There's a second level of management recommendations that are based on some excellent research and represent a much more solid base. It's more in tune with what is going to really pay off for you and your company. And you can build your base in a number of ways. Research shows that men and women who are successful managers tend to be students of people and readers of biography. It's been said that the first half of a man's education comes from reading books, but that the second half of his education comes from reading people. As you work your way into the management arena, as you are entrusted with increasing levels of responsibility, you will find that ready-made answers to your problems are less readily available. Increasingly, you find yourself in an unstructured and uncharted area in which your own vision, your own experience, your own gut-level feelings, and your own interpretation of data is all you have to operate with. Learning how to read people and learning the subtleties and realities of the situations around you will help you join the ranks of successful managers. I'm encouraged to hear that the Book of Five Rings by a Japanese writer known as Musashi has had a place on the bestseller list among American executives. Musashi lived in the 16th century and was a samurai, a professional warrior, a paladin for hire. He executed 60 opponents, and at the end of his long and rather brutal and bloody career, Musashi sat down and wrote a book of strategies and suggestions. If you want to win, he said, this is the way you've got to do it. Now, am I suggesting you go out and buy yourself a samurai sword? Well, it might solve some of your immediate problems, but no, that's not what I'm suggesting. I am suggesting that that book is a basis, a philosophical touchstone for many Japanese executives and managers. It represents for them a set of values, understandings, a philosophy of action and strategy which they follow. And my only reason for encouragement when I hear American managers are reading it is that these are managers who are learning to study their competition. They realize they need to have a real awareness of how their competition thinks if they are to win. Another suggestion that is certainly a solidly based recommendation comes from the work of Eugene Jennings at Michigan State. He identified career channels followed by lower-level managers and then followed these people upward as they became directors, vice presidents, and presidents of major corporations. He determined, for example, that accounting and finance, legal or marketing divisions were all fast-track areas for promotion to the executive suite. That is, certain knowledge bases translated into later success. One of the other points Jennings made in his research was that upper-level executives also at one point or another in their career were crucial subordinates. That is, they became attached to a senior-level executive and performed those tasks needed by that executive in order for the executive to be successful. And as you think about your career now, who are you understudying? Are you working for a man or woman who is definitely going someplace, or are you in a dead-end position? If you're at a dead end in your current situation, and if you know in your heart of hearts that you've got what it takes to be an uncommon leader, you may have to face the unpleasant or painful decision of making a career move. In this way, you can reposition yourself with another executive so that you can learn and be effective. Jennings found that when successful executives move up the hierarchy, they remember those staff people who helped them, and they take those staff people with them when they go up. In short, to be powerful in management, focus on contribution, focus on confidence and not criticism, focus on character, not carping. Downplay the importance of position and personality games. If you concentrate on getting things done, chances are you'll get what you want in the long run. A lot of what you're going to learn and do isn't glamorous or exciting, but it's effective. It's research-based, and while not a complete set of answers, it will help you in your career. Nothing can replace mastery of this in your effort to move ahead. Finally, in the major area of emphasis in this session, I want to suggest that you're going to be called to a new level of excellence, far beyond the level of superficiality, and even beyond the level of solid management understanding. You are being called to the realm of uncommon leadership. There's a great story from ancient Greek history that illustrates uncommon leadership. Many of you may not be fully aware of ancient Greek history, and yet I would dare say that everyone listening has an awareness of the three greatest names of Greek philosophy: Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. What many people don't know, though they know the names and some of the contributions of these great thinkers, is that each of them directly interacted with the other. It's an astounding thing to discover that Socrates never wrote anything down at all. He was a teacher who walked from city to city and was paid a fee for the lessons he would give in each locale. He was the earliest of the management consultants, if you will. And as he traveled, he would attract various students who were fascinated by this man's great mind and the strength of his character, the kind of man who would rather drink hemlock than give up his beliefs. One of those students was a young man by the name of Plato, and the only reason we know anything at all about Socrates is because Plato wrote down what his teacher said. These became known as the Dialogues of Socrates. Plato took the great man's thinking and proved on it with his own massive intellect and created a number of concepts about the state and about how government should work. Even today, his ideas have a part in our own U.S. Constitution and some of our management thinking as well. Plato, in turn, had a series of students, and the most notable was a young man by the name of Aristotle. Plato directly taught Aristotle. And here in Greek history, the three greatest minds, each a direct instructor, each adding to the work done by the previous generation. Socrates to Plato to Aristotle. There wouldn't be another triple play like that until Tinkers to Evers to Chance. And yet the story doesn't end there, because Aristotle, in turn, had a young student, a student whose name and fame would live forever in history. When he was 21, Aristotle was approached by King Philip of Macedonia. Like other concerned parents of the day, Philip was not happy with the public school system, and so he wanted a private tutor for his young son. The boy was 11 years of age at the time, and his name was Alexander. In time, history would call him Alexander the Great, and for 1 year, Aristotle taught young Alexander. He taught him about math, about politics, about philosophy, and about how to lead people. One day, as the story goes, they stopped in the middle of a math lesson, and Alexander asked his teacher, "How many is one?" I suppose there are a lot of ways to answer a question like that. You could say, well, it's a unity, it's a prime number, it's half of two, it's two halves. And Aristotle might have been tempted to give any one of these immediate responses. But realizing the importance of his teaching role and sensing an opportunity, he asked for a day to think about it. He said, "I'll give you an answer tomorrow." The next day he came back and taught the young Alexander, this future king, this future extender of Greek civilization throughout the entire known world, this important leadership lesson, that in the area of human affairs, of human leadership, one can be a very great number. As you approach your management responsibility, and as you consider the need for your important future contributions, let me ask you that same question. How many is one? And how many are you?